But then it's the final talk. I'm afraid I'm not going to say anything about mock or modularity. Certainly no moonshine. Not like Greg. I'm not even going to try. And I'm just barely going to make string theory. So there you go. But that's the end of the meeting. So what I want to explain to you is some work I've been involved in over the last few years, mostly with Rajesh Gopakumar, in trying to understand the higher spin CFT dualities and how they relate to string theory. So let me start very, very broadly by saying that this is sort of in the big context of the ADS CFT duality. So people know, there's the idea that a superstring on ADS 5 process 5 or on some other version of this is dual to some field theory on the boundary, say SUN superangulars in four dimensions. And the basic paradigm of this is the relation between the parameters on the two sides. So on the ADS side, there is a radius and a Planck coupling constant, which tells you the Planck scale telling you the strength of the quantum gravity effects and the string scale. And on the gauge theory side, there's a rank of the gauge group and there's a coupling constant. And the relation is that the rank of the gauge group is related to the radius in Planck units. Then the coupling constant is related to the coupling constant. And then at large n, which is what we are going to look at, because we don't know how to do quantum gravity, at least as of yet. So we want the radius to be large in Planck units so that we can sort of think of it as ignore quantum gravity effect. So we're going to be at large n. And then at large n, gauge theories develop an effective coupling constant, which is this TUF parameter, g squared n. And g squared n is related to the radius of this ADS space in string units. So the regime we are going to be interested in order to understand this duality quantitatively, is the regime in which the gauge theory is weakly coupled, and therefore lambda is going to be small. And as a consequence, the radius of this ADS space in string units is small. Or another way of saying this, the string is large relative to the size of the space, or of the same size of the space. So this is the opposite limit to the usual point particle limit where you can approximate string theory in terms of supergravity. That's the limit in which the string is very large, very floppy. And as a consequence, the string excitations, the vibrational modes, will be very low-lying. And in the extremal, sort of the ultimate limit, they will become massless. And therefore, this is what's called to be the tensionless limit of string theory. So these are nice words to say that weakly coupled gauge theory is dual to this tensionless limit of string theory. But the idea is that there is a redeeming feature in this tensionless limit of string theory. And the redeeming feature is that you acquire an infinite number of massless higher spin fields coming from the vibrational excitations of the string. So the idea is in this very special corner of string theory on ADS space, this string theory develops much more symmetry than it ordinarily has, much, much more than in a supergravity regime. Namely, all the excitation modes of the strings all become massless, and they describe, from a space-time point of view, massless higher spin fields. And each of these massless fields comes with its own gauge symmetry. So this resulting theory is as symmetric as it gets. It has many, many, many gauge symmetries. It has a graviton, has a spin 3 gauge symmetry, spin 4, and so on. And the idea is that because of this enormous symmetry, there's yet another chance to describe this theory qualitatively without understanding all the details. Because we are going to be very far away from a regime where we can directly do a world sheet description of string theory in this background. So this is this idea that in this regime where you look at the tensionless limit of string theory has this gigantic symmetry. This is in some sense the maximally unbroken phase of string theory. This is the phase from which you maybe should start describing string theory. And then the normal background is really the broken Higgs phase where all of these massless higher spin fields haven't acquired a mass. So this is sometimes referred to as the Grand Boeuf because there is it's not just one Higgs mechanism eating one massless gauge fields, but you have to think of them as sitting in a Cambridge College opposite each other and eating themselves pairwise, all simultaneously, and all this symmetry gets broken. But if you think about 100 years down the line how you would describe string theory, then you maybe think that maybe that's the point where you should start, and then describe the sort of more conventional string theory as the broken phase as a consequence of some massive Higgs mechanism. Now, this is just a pure speculation, so this is fine, but this is sort of the motivation for looking at higher spin theories and trying to see how they fit into this ADS CFT correspondence. Now, the other important ingredient in order to understand how this fits into string theory is that in this very special limit of free Young-Mills theory, there is a subsector of the theory that closes onto itself, namely the bilinears in terms of the elementary Young-Mills fields. And they should correspond to, from the dual string theory point of view, not to the full string spectrum, but just to the leading redshift trajectory. So the idea is that you have to go to the special point in moduli space, and then you look at a piece of the duality, namely the quadratic piece and the leading ratio trajectory, and you hope you find a duality on this sort of subsector of things. And this should be simpler because it'll involve fewer degrees of freedom, and it's effectively a free description. So you would hope to be able to establish this kind of duality perturbatively, and then, depending on how optimistic you are, you would think that maybe starting from there, you could try to prove aspects of the ADS-CFT correspondence, even going away from this very special point. So this is what's meant to be by this vector-like higher spin CFT duality. It contains much fewer degrees of freedom than a full string spectrum. It's more like one leading ratio trajectory and the bilinears from the point of view of the Young-Mills fields. Okay, so this is sort of the introduction I've been given for a number of years now. And at this stage, you would then say, okay, this is the general motivation to consider dualities of the type Vasiliev theories. These are these theories involving infinitely many massless higher spin fields to vector-like weakly coupled conformal field theories. And then until recently, from this point onwards, you would never ever mention again string theory, because then you would turn the page, you would look at these dualities, you would propose something, test it, and feel good about yourself. Now, what the progress in the last year or so has been is that we've understood how these dualities, which we can check in quite some detail, how they actually appear rather naturally within a stringy ADS-CFT correspondence. And this is what I want to explain to you towards the end of the talk, how it is really these sort of vector-like dualities you can write down without any reference to string theory initially, how they actually come back and sit inside the stringy ADS-CFT correspondence. Okay, so what I'm going to concentrate on is one specific incarnation of this. So this really started, this whole area started with the proposal of Klebanov and Polyakov relating a higher spin theory in ADS4 to a three-dimensional conformal field theory, the ON vector model in the large end limit. But what I'm going to look at is one dimension lower, where we are having a higher spin theory in ADS3 being dual to a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And the advantage is the obvious one, two-dimensional conformal field theories. Well, that makes at least a little bit of contact with the theme of this workshop. This is vertex operator algebra, so lots of pretty mathematics, lots of structure, things you can understand. And then higher spin theory in ADS3 is also much, much simpler than higher spin theory in higher dimensions. You will not see this because I'm not going to describe to you what higher spin theories in higher dimensions look like. You will probably leave this talk, if you've never heard a talk about higher spin theories, thinking that they are not so bad after all. And I don't want to destroy your illusion. So in three dimensions, that's a good summary of it. But in higher dimensions, life is much harder. Anyway, so this is also a little bit simpler because it's partially a topological duality. The pure higher spin theory is topological. But in order for this duality to work, you have to add propagating degrees of freedom, namely a complex scalar field of a specific mass. And I'll explain also in detail where this comes about and what the mass is and so on. Okay, so I should say this version of the duality is bosonic. So this is a feature at this stage, although in order to relate it to string theory, it shall later become supersymmetric. It can be tested in quite some detail. And the first half of the talk I want to spend explaining to you in particular. So this is my attempt of connecting this to VRA theory by explaining to you in which sense the quantum symmetries. Now, I want to use the hockey stick. I didn't really want to use this. It's part of the motivation for giving this talk, is to hold a hockey stick. So I want to explain to you how the quantum symmetry is a match on both sides. And that's really an exercise in vertex operator algebra theory. And then towards the end of the talk, I want to explain to you how that relates to the stringy duality, and that requires making it supersymmetric. Okay, so the key point in order to see that the quantum symmetries agree is the claim that there's a vertex operator algebra or a chiral symmetry algebra, or however you want to phrase it, that is generated by one spin field for each spin. So it has a field of spin 2, one field of spin 3, one field of spin 4, one field of spin 5, and so on, infinitely many. And if you write down the axioms of a vertex operator algebra and you check for the associativity of the product, then the claim is that this algebra is characterized by two parameters. One is the familiar central charge that most vertex operator algebras contain as a free parameter. But this specific family of spins is believed, and we have some evidence for this, to have a second free parameter that you can also freely dial. And there's this two-parameter family of vertex operator algebras. And if this is true, then in some sense that will prove that the quantum symmetries have to exist, because as I will argue, they have to land on this algebra. And if this algebra is so highly constrained, then it has to land on the same thing, because there is nothing else it can land on. So I'll explain to you in somewhat more detail where this comes about. But this is part of the way of proving that the symmetries match. Okay, so let's start a little bit at the beginning. So one side of this duality is the higher spin theory in ADS3. And as I said, there's a very simple way of characterizing higher spin theories in ADS3. And that really comes from the fact there's a simple way of characterizing pure gravity in ADS3. Namely this, at least on the level of classical physics, and one should say right from the start, higher spin theories are at the moment classical theories, just equations of motions that are satisfy all the gauge conditions, not clear how to quantize them. Although the way we are going to embed it is suggesting a way to quantize them, but at the moment, Vasiliev theory is just purely classical. So purely classically, pure gravity is the same as the Chern-Simons theory based on SL2R, pure gravity on ADS3. And in the higher spin description is the generalization where you replace the gauge group or gauge algebra SL2R by an algebra which is sometimes called HS lambda, and which you should really think of as being SL lambda. So if you've ever asked yourself, what's SL9 3/4, then there is a very definite answer to it. And it's a pretty answer that you can understand in a lot of detail. So how does this come about? Well, let's take the universal enveloping algebra of SL2. So SL2 is the Lie algebra that's generated by J plus, J minus, and J3. And now the idea is we're going to look at the universal enveloping algebra of SL2. So what is this? So this is basically all the words you can write with these three letters, modulo the fact that you can use the commutation relations to bring the letters into the form. So this is a pretty boring set of words because it's only made of three letters, A, B, and C. And furthermore, every word starts with a number of A's, then there's a number of B's, and then there's a number of C's. So not super exciting, but still that's the vector space of the universal enveloping algebra. And this is clearly an associative algebra because if you have two such words, you just multiply them together and then you have to reshuffle them until all the A's are the beginning and then the B's and the C's. So this is clearly an associative algebra. So what is the basis for this algebra? Well, there is the no letter word, which is the one. Then you have the one letter word. So there are three of them, G plus, G3, and G minus. Then there are the two letter words. And because I can bring them into this order, they will be of this form. J plus J plus, J plus J3, J plus J minus, J3, 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 J minus, J minus, J minus. So these are the two letter words, and then there are likewise three letter words, four letter words one doesn't mention, and so on. And now this space contains an ideal. So the ideal is that you have the quadratic Casimir. The quadratic Casimir is something like J plus J minus plus J minus J plus plus a half times J3 squared. And what you're going to do is we're going to divide out this vector space by all the relations that set the quadratic Casimir equal to a number, namely a quarter times lambda squared minus one. So if you look at this, you see these two pieces appear in the quadratic Casimir. So if you divide out by this relation, which means whenever you see the quadratic Casimir slotted anywhere inside your words, you replace it by a number, then out of these one, two, three, four, five, six states, you're going to retain five. So what you're going to see is there's one state here, three states here, five states here. If you do the exercise for the three letter words and you divide out by the quadratic Casimir, you will find there are seven here, nine here, and so on. Now this is clearly still an associative algebra because dividing by something, the quadratic Casimir that commutes with everything inside, doesn't destroy the property of the associative product. So this is still an associative algebra. So even after I've divided out by this, I can still multiply this stuff. And once it's an associative algebra, I can turn it into a Lie algebra in the most stupid manner, namely by declaring that the commutator of A and B is A times B minus B times A. Yes?
My question. So in the full ADS-CFT, we can think of the Tuft coupling as being related to a dynamical field in the bulk gravity theory, that of the dilaton, for instance.
Yes.
What is the bulk interpretation of lambda here?
That'll come, but it'll be a parameter it's this parameter here. So it'll appear in the commutation relations of this Lie algebra, and therefore it'll appear in the structure. So this lambda you shouldn't really think of as the Tuft parameter. This parameter is a parameter that characterizes inequivalent higher spin theories, and it appears in the explicit commutator formula of this Lie algebra. So it's going to appear in the three-point coupling of your fields.
It's a scalar that appears in the bulk action, but it's
I mean, on the level of a higher spin theory, it isn't. No, it's just a free parameter that just characterizes different higher spin theories.
In the full string theory,
it probably should arise as the BEF of something, but yes, that's a good question. Okay, so at the moment I'm just in the process of defining this Lie algebra, and what I said that with the associative algebra, you can always make a Lie algebra, and the Jacobi identity is satisfied because it comes from an associative algebra, so there's nothing to check. So therefore, you get a Lie algebra for any value of the parameter lambda, and you can check that different values of lambda lead to inequivalent Lie algebras. There's no field redefinition or basis redefinition that would make it identical. And what you find, why do you call this SL lambda? Well, what you find is if you choose lambda, say, to be equal to 3, then you will find that all the generators that lie below the dotted line form an ideal. So the commutator of anybody with somebody down here lands down here. And therefore, you can set all of this to 0. You can divide out by it. And you're left over with a Lie algebra that has dimension 1 plus 3 plus 5. Well, the one we also removed, this is saying that this is this C factor, the one sort of disappears. So we just have this will never appear in commutator, so we can also divide out. So if we do this, we end up with a Lie algebra of dimension 3 plus 5, which is 8. And it's not just a Lie algebra of dimension 8, it is actually SL3. SL3 has dimension 8, and it's precisely this 8-dimensional algebra you get. And if you choose lambda equal to 4, then the chop takes place here. Everything below this line gets chopped. And then you have 3 plus 5 plus 7. 8 plus 7 is 15. And 8 plus 7, 15 happens to be the dimension of SL4. And it isn't just the dimension. It's actually equal to this Lie algebra. It's not obvious, but it is a simple Lie algebra, unless lambda is one of these integer values. And once it's simple, so it's not obvious that when I chop that this would be simple, but it turns out to be simple, it turns out to be SLR. So this is the legitimate definition of an algebra that has the right to be called SL lambda because it reduces to SLn when lambda is equal to n, but it's defined for any value of lambda, including 9¾. Yes?
I mean, it's not strictly true that the Chern-Simons theory based on SL2R gives you gravity, right? So in this construction, are we to think that...
So in which sense are you saying this is not strictly true?
Well, we don't know.
Boundary terms, or classical versus quantum, or what level...
Partition functions not agreeing with what we expect for partition.
Well, but I mean, this is on the level of the classical field equations, because that's the level on which Vasiljev theory is defined. I mean, so on the level of classical field equations, I think it's a true statement to say that Chern-Simons theory based on SL2 is gravity.
There's always this issue of invertibility of the metric.
Right, but that's
when you want to impose gravity.
Yeah. So this, but on the level of classical field equations, I think we're okay. Okay, so what are the generators of HS lambda? Well, you can label them by the number of letters. So these generators you call V2n, these you call V3n, these you call V4n, and so on. And n will run here between plus 1, 0, and minus 1. That's basically the charge under the adjoint action of J3. So in this case, it'll run from plus 2, plus 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2. So the generators of this algebra are of the form VSN, where n is in modulus less than s. And s runs from 2 to infinity. And this is just the Chern-Simons theory in the bulk. And then you've been drummed in at grad school. Then whenever you are given ADS3 theory, you're going to calculate the asymptotic symmetry algebra, because that's the way to find out what the dual conformal field theory wants to be. So you do this calculation, and what you find is that you get what you would call the classical W infinity algebra, and basically you can certainly at this time of the day, you should be happy with this argument. So if you start with SL2, that's generated by L0 and L plus minus 1, and you may know that this becomes 0, 0, so this becomes LN. So apparently the rule is that N being restricted from 0 plus minus 1 becomes anything. So here, likewise, VSN with N being restricted in this funny wedge just becomes VSN with N not being restricted. And that gives you some W infinity algebra, some algebra that looks like the Lie algebra associated to a conformal field theory that has one spin field for each spin. And that's in fact true. That's the correct answer of this analysis. So what this suggests is that a dual conformal field theory should therefore have this W infinity symmetry, and this parameter lambda goes along for the ride because it appears in the commutation relations here, and therefore it'll trickle through to the commutation relations of this W infinity algebra. And you mean going to the asymptotic symmetry algebra?
Yeah, for W infinity around lambda. The higher spin level.
I mean, the calculation that you do is always the same. I mean, you ask the gauge. So because this is a topological theory, every two solutions are related by a gauge transformation. So you ask, what is the set of solutions that satisfy your boundary condition modulo those gauge transformations that vanish out at infinity? And the spectrum generating algebra of that is the asymptotic symmetry algebra. And you can simply calculate it by doing precisely what I've said. You write on the most general solution that satisfies the boundary conditions. You look at all the gauge transformations that map this boundary condition into itself, and you study the Lie algebra that's generated by this, the Poisson bracket that's generated by this gauge transformation, and that gives you this algebra that I call W infinity of lambda. So if you were to write it as a Lie algebra, it would be generated by these generators, and I'll come to the, you'll see more of the structure of it in a second.
Is there a
Well, the geometrical understanding is a little bit more complicated. I mean, it's not, so Virasoro's have diffeomorphisms, but the geometrical interpretation of this W symmetry is something I wish I would understand. Maybe you understand this better. I think people have speculated about it, but I am very confused. Yeah, there's some bundle and lots of complicated words that I don't understand. And I wish I could say something more intelligent about it, but somehow I can't. Anyway, so this is the asymptotic symmetry algebra, and then the gist of our proposal is that this algebra is to be identified with the larger limit of a specific set of rational VOAs, of rational conformal field theories, namely this WNK minimal models, and I'll describe to them in a second, where you take, you keep the parameter lambda, which is n over n plus k, so this is not to be thought of as the Tuft parameter, it's just a parameter characterizing theories fixed. So you take n and k to infinity simultaneously while keeping lambda fixed. That's the proposal. So what are these WNK theories? Well, they are minimal models. They are, in particular, you can describe them as cosets. So there are cosets of the form SUN level K plus SUN level 1 over SUN level K plus 1. So if you don't know what a coset is, then that's bad. Then you should go home and read the yellow book. For the purpose of this course, for this talk, it doesn't really matter whether you know or not. The only thing that matters is that these are conformal field theories that we understand in as much detail as we understand any conformal field theory. I mean, we know the set of representations, we know the set of anomalous dimensions, we know the fusion rules, we know the characters, we know, there's a technique to calculate all of that. And the other thing you should know is that these are really generalizations of models you should feel ashamed about if you haven't heard of them, like the Ising model, the tricritical Ising model, the three-state pots model, and so on. So these are sort of, fairly sensible conformal field theories. And what they are really the higher spin analog of the Virasoro minimal models. So if n is n, then they are generated by fields of spin 2 up to n. And so the models with n being equal to 2 are just the Virasoro minimal model. So this is the famous SU2 level k plus SU2 level 1 over SU2 level k plus 1 gives you the minimal model series, where, and that reproduces 1 minus 6 over m into m plus 1, with the 6 being upstairs Terry. And likewise, you can calculate it here, and this is the formula for general n and k. So these are sort of very well understood minimal models. Now, when I say that this is the same, there's a little bit of a non-trivial statement hidden in there, because you see, what you get out of this asymptotic symmetry analysis is a commutative Poisson algebra, whereas what coset theories give you are honest quantum W algebra, a commutators that satisfy the Jacobi identities. Now, normally, when you teach or learn quantum mechanics, you think Poisson algebras and the commutator algebras are essentially the same. One are these curly brackets, one are the straight brackets, and then there's a factor of I over H bar that you smuggle in and everything is good, and it doesn't really matter whether you use curly brackets or straight brackets. Now this is true if the algebra is linear, but these algebras are non-linear, and as a consequence, you can't just replace curly brackets by straight brackets and get away without it. So let me explain to you where this complication arises. So it comes from the fact that the Poisson algebra is non-linear, and therefore, you have to work a little bit, but there is effectively a unique consistent quantum algebra that has the right to be called the quantization of this Poisson algebra. So in order to give you a flavor for how this works, let's look at the first Poisson bracket, and I've written it already in commutator language. So this used to be a Poisson bracket of two functions, and I've done a Fourier expansion and replaced curly bracket by straight brackets. And when you do that, that's what you get. And the problem is, there is this nonlinear term here. So on the right-hand side, you get a thing that's really a certain mode of L times L. And the problem is, if you calculate the Jacobi identity of this with L, it'll fail. This doesn't satisfy the Jacobi identity. But there is a, it's a small way of fixing the Jacobi identity. What you have to do is you have to replace L times L by the normal ordered product. Okay, that wasn't so hard to guess. What else can you do? But what's a little bit less obvious is that there is 8 and 3 over C, and 8 and 3 over C becomes 8 and 3 over C plus 22 over 5. And 22 over 5 is not because I like 22 over 5. It's the outcome of a calculation. That's the only number, so that this commutator together with the Virasoro algebra satisfies the Jacobi identity. If you choose some other number here, it'll fail. So this number is probably some one loop correction, which comes from some normal ordering effect, but you can just determine it without thinking about anything, just by demanding the associativity or the Jacobi identity. Now, this was for W3 with W3, so you can do it for W3 with W4, W3 with W5, and so on and so on and so on. Obviously, there are infinitely many, and we haven't checked all of them. We have done the similar analysis for the first, I don't know, 20 or so commutators, and it all works exactly the same way, but we don't have a closed formula for what this one loop shift is, and therefore we haven't really checked that this exists, but all the indications are in all of these cases you can fix the failure for the Jacobi identity in a manner like that. So that's the first step you have to do. And then the second step you have to do is that you have to worry a little bit about the structure constants that appear in the algebra. So again, if I write, so here I haven't written the Poisson bracket, so this is the Poisson bracket of W3 and W3, and now I write it in terms of fields rather than modes. So what I've just written was the central term, the stress energy terms, and this lambda 4 term. And if you work it out, you find there's also a W4 term. So the spin 4 field appears in the Poisson bracket of spin 3 with spin 3. Now,
the central extension of the spin 3 field is the same as C as well as in the Virasoro.
Yes,
shape.
Yes, that's also fixed by.
But that's fixed by the Jacobi
yes,
as well.
Yes.
You can't have two different.
Nope.
It's not like
Okay. I mean, I claim there's the two free parameters, lambda and C. So that this I mean seriously.
Okay.
No,
well, I don't
know
if it was due to
No, this is. You can try, but yeah. Anyway, so we should think a little bit about normalization. You see, you can obviously normalize fields any way you like. So I've chosen a specific normalization for W3 by saying that the stress energy tensor appears with factor 2. So I can't change the normalization of W3 any longer because that's really been fixed by saying that these coefficients are what they are. Now, once I fix the normalization of W3, I can fix the normalization of W4, and I've done so by choosing this coefficient to be 4. I mean, if I chose W4, if I replaced W4 by 2W4, then this factor of 4 would be a 2. But having said it, it's a 4, fixes the normalization of W4. So then I can look at the Poisson bracket of W3 with W4, and I can ask, what's the coefficient with which W3 appears in it? Now, remember, I fixed the normalization of W3 and I fixed the normalization of W4. So this coefficient I can't change anymore by changing my normalization. So this is a parameter that has a meaning. And if you calculate it, what you find, this is the meaning. It depends on lambda. This is this parameter that appears in the commutation relations once I divided out the Casimir. And it reemerges here in this coefficient for this commutator. That depends on lambda in this manner. Don't worry about the lambda squared minus 4. This is a normalization artifact. I've just decided to divide by something that blows up at lambda equals to 2. But that's just because you see at lambda equals to 2, nothing really survives. Everything is boring. There is no spin 3 field and so on. So because then everything truncates. OK, so now we have learned that all the other structure constants acquire 1 over C corrections. So you should be liberal. You should expect this also to acquire 1 over C corrections. And what you find is that that's the correct 1 over C correction to this formula. It's a very specific 1 over C correction. That's the exact formula as a function of C and lambda. And you see that when you take C very large, you can drop the second half of it. Then this becomes lambda squared minus 9. This becomes lambda squared minus 4. And here you just get the 64 over 5. Now, why do I say that this is the correct formula? Well, remember that SL lambda, when lambda is equal to an integer, becomes SLn. The asymptotic symmetry algebra of SLn is the WN algebra. I know the representation theory of the WN algebra. I can match the representation theory of the WN algebra with the structure constant, and I find that this is the correct answer. I believe it's the only answer. Obviously, I'm not a mathematician, so probably I'm allowed to add, so Terry is probably about to ask me, why can't you add sine pi lambda to this numerator? And the answer is obviously on this level, I could add it to it because that would be zero at all integer values of lambda. And I know only this from comparing integers, but that's like all of these integrable model type predictions where you assume that you don't have functions of that sort. But up to functions of that sort, I believe this is unique. Okay, so this is gives you a prediction for what these structure constants look like, and we've also checked this. So we've looked at the case lambda equal to zero. There you can describe it in terms of complex fermions, or lambda equals one complex bosons. You can honestly do this calculation. You can calculate this coefficient, and it turns out to match precisely with this number on the nose. This is exact. No one over C, no nothing. This is exact. Okay, so this is just the first structure constant. So you can ask, what about the higher structure constants? So fortunately, the Bond group in the 90s have worked them out, and you can find in their papers expressions like this. You're not meant to be able to read them in detail. You're meant to see that they are very complicated. What's actually impressive is that they didn't make a single mistake. This, they had nothing to compare this to, but they did it absolutely correctly. This impressed me very much. Anyway, what Rajesh and I observed is that you can write all of these constants in terms of functions of C times gamma, where gamma is this structure constant, which we call gamma squared. And what we could see is that all of these higher complicated expressions could be written in terms of functions and C times gamma. So the entire lambda dependence, if you look at this, this has some horrendous lambda dependence, but the whole lambda dependence is via gamma. It doesn't independently depend on lambda. It actually only depends on this specific combination of lambda and C, and in addition on C. So this is not entirely obvious, but it turns out to be true. And what this suggests is that all of these higher structure constants are recursively fixed by the Jacobi identities. Because you see, the low-lying Jacobi identities, they involve the central charge, and they involve gamma. So if all the higher structure constants are fixed by that, then by recursively solving the Jacobi identities, you must be able to express every structure constant in terms of the stuff that appeared in your low commutators, namely C and gamma. So the fact that you can write them in terms of C and gamma is a very strong hint that they are indeed fixed by the Jacobi identities, and this is what we've checked. We've simply written down the most general ansatz for the commutator, imposed all the Jacobi identities, and recursively solved all the coefficients, and what we found is that all of them are uniquely determined by C and gamma to the level to which we've checked it. We've only checked up to commutators of spin 5 with spin 5. I mean, that's, I think we've checked about 40 or so structure constants. All of them involving some computer support. I mean, you can't do this by hand. It's very, very complicated. But what we found is that all of them are determined in terms of gamma and C uniquely. So this suggests that the entire Lie algebra really only depends on gamma and C rather than directly on lambda. Now, this is something which the mathematicians should be able to prove, but we haven't been able to prove it. But that's a prediction based on lots of sweat and computer power. Now, what's intriguing about this is, you see, if you think about this now as a function of lambda, you see gamma squared is this specific ratio of polynomials in lambda. So if you think about it, you see that in the Lie algebra, that only depends on central charge and gamma. But if I want to think of it as being parameterized in terms of the central charge and lambda, then this means there are three values of lambda that lead to the same Lie algebra. Because you can read this equation as a cubic equation for lambda given gamma and C. So given gamma and C, this is a cubic equation for lambda, but the Lie algebras with the same value of gamma and C are the same Lie algebras. So for a given value of C, there are three values of lambda that are the isomorphic Lie algebra because they give you the same value of gamma, and all the structure constants only depend on gamma and C. Now, this is not entirely obvious what the roots, these three roots are, but what happens is that if you take C to be the central charge of the WNK minimal models, and you set lambda equal to n, which means you're sitting precisely at the Wn minimal models, what you find is that the other two solutions are lambda equal to n over n plus k and lambda equal to minus n over n plus k plus 1. I mean, it's not obvious, but you just have to take this equation, plug in the complicated equation for C, put lambda equals to n, and look for the other two solutions of lambda. And what you find is that these are the other two solutions of lambda. And what this suggests is that this Wn Lie algebra is the same as the quantization, the quantum algebra associated to lambda equal to n over n plus k at the appropriate value of the central charge. And because there's only one such Lie algebra, however you quantize your asymptotic symmetry algebra, you have to land on one of these. And then this triality relation tells you that the minimal models is really exactly the same as the quantization of this W infinity algebra at this value of lambda. This is true at finite n and k. It's an exact statement about this Lie algebra. It's not not any approximation whatsoever.
Before comparing to the minimal model, the roots can be imaginary.
Yes.
It's complex as well, and if gamma is real, then this theory is still unitary, so there's no reason.
Well, unitarity is a complicated game. I'm not going to say anything about unitarity. Unitarity is tricky. Unitarity, I don't know. But on the level of Lie algebras, I mean, Terry made a big point about BOA doesn't care about unitarity that much. So all I've said is totally independent of unitarity. I'm just having a VOA. Jacobi identities are satisfied. I have a good representation theory and so on. I don't know much about unitarity. So it's certainly not true that all real values of gamma will lead to unitary theories. This is not very common.
But it's just governed by gamma and lambda. If gamma
sure, I mean, the unitarity is governed by gamma and lambda, but I can't tell you for which values of gamma and C it'll be unitary. So what this sort of first part was meant to show you, so we started with this theory, then we calculated the asymptotic symmetry algebra, and this asymptotic symmetry algebra is actually the quantization. This is the classical Poisson algebra. You quantize it. Whichever way you quantize it, it's going to land on the minimum models, where the relation between this lambda and this n and k is lambda is equal to n over n plus k. That's precisely this identification here. And then there's a relation of C to the length scale that appears in the Chern-Simon theory, or the level of the Chern-Simon theory. So this gives you this one-to-one correspondence between these higher spin theories and ADS3 and these minimum models where you have the precise correspondence between the parameters on both sides. I'm sure there is, but unknown to me. I mean, so we understand parts of the representation theory, but we don't understand, I don't have a complete picture about the representation theory. It's an interesting question. I wish this algebra should be a good algebra, so there should be some interesting structure theory for it. Okay, so this was matching the symmetries. So now you would like to see that the spectrum is really the same. The degrees of freedom on the two sides is the same. I mean, this is this old idea of Witten's when he wrote down the partition function of pure gravity on ADS and he tried to guess the dual CFT. So we want to put this picture into practice. So now we have a higher spin theory in ADS side. So we're going to calculate the one loop partition function and we want to compare it to the torus partition function of the dual CFT. So what's the idea is that the higher spin fields we've described so far only correspond to the vacuum representation. They're just things that sit in the VOA. And in order to account for the representations of this W algebra, you have to add something to the higher spin field theory. And the idea is that there's only one thing you know how to add, which is a complex scalar field whose mass is determined in terms of lambda, because that's an old work of Vasiliev that tells you that you are consistently able to associate a complex scalar field to this higher spin theory in three dimensions. Absolutely, it's topological, just like pure gravity. But this is now not topological anymore because this carries the propagating degrees of freedom. This is necessary in order to give some meat to your dual CFT. Otherwise, you're not going to have any representations. Yes.
The negative mass word means that the CFT probably has a relevant perturbation.
No. This is just a Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. I mean, this is just ADS3, so this is just scaled in such a way. The scalar field having a negative mass is just within the Brighton-Lohner.
It's allowed, but it means there should be a relevant perturbation.
There are also relevant perturbations, indeed. Yes.
Do you know what they call you?
Well, some of them we've studied, yes. Yes, I mean, there's some of them map you between the minimum models. So, for example, there's one that changes k to k minus 1. So the zero adjoint will do that. So what the calculation you have to do now is to calculate the analog of Witten's partition function for ADS3. So this is what you get from the higher spin field. So this is some sort of heat kernel type calculation. And then you add in the contribution of the scalar fields. And this you should now match. This is a certain power series in Q and Q bar. And you should expand it out. And this should agree with your conformal field theory partition function. And that's a non-trivial test because you see, here there is you can't tweak this formula. This formula is given to you by knowing what the one loop partition function on ADS3 is. And the idea is that this really corresponds to the WN modes, and this corresponds to the higher powers of these representations. And what we've shown is that analytically, so if you expand this out to any order in Q and Q bar, and you compare it to the CFT partition function where you take the characters of lambda zero, you open the yellow book on page 500 and something, you take the k goes to infinity limit, you take these characters, you take the mod squared of them, you expand them out in power zero sig of Q and Q bar, it's going to match this formula to any arbitrary order. So this is an analytic statement, and we've checked it by hand, but it's, we've also found an analytic proof for it. So what this tells you is that this perturbative piece of the higher spin theory, namely the higher spin field plus the scalar field, is equal to the partition function of this part of your WNK minimum models. This is not the full WNK minimum model partition function. It's in particular not modular invariant. But you take this part of the partition function, and you calculate the characters, and you take the larger NK limit, then it matches precisely this formula on the nose.
So lambda zero is greater than primary.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So lambda
of absolutely, of SUN. Yeah. So lambda is the weight. So you sum over all the weights of SUN, and you're only looking at half of the, well.
You're not, you don't put any cutoff K because K is bound to infinity.
That's it, yes. So in the limit, so this formula is only true in the limit that NK goes to infinity, but that's a quasi-classical formula, right? I mean, this is only the one loop piece. There is higher loop pieces which will be suppressed by inverse powers of the central charge. So you're just comparing the one loop piece, but that just matches on the nose with this part of the CFT partition function. And there are really two different calculations. This is the heat kernel calculation in ADS3, and that's the yellow book on page 600. So this is, and they match. I mean, they didn't have to match, but they do match. Now, obviously, you will see that this is not the full partition function. So this, I think, corresponds to the fact that this part of the spectrum is not modular invariant. So if you're trying to quantize this, you're going to run into difficulties. But Vasiliev theory at that stage is just the classical theory. So on the level of the classical theory, this is the perturbative piece, and that's the CFT piece it corresponds to. And there's some belief that the other representations, namely those that involve a non-trivial label here, correspond to some classical solutions of the higher spin theory. And Alejandro has worked on that. And so there's some evidence for this. This has been further developed, but this hasn't been checked to quite the same degree as this this calculation. I mean, here it's much easier because you really can calculate both sides and compare. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about the bosonic part of this higher spin CFT duality, and you can check it in quite some detail because you have good tools. Three and two dimensions is a nice place to be because you have sharp tools. Now, in order to understand how to relate this to string theory, you want to make it supersymmetric. Not because there's anything wrong with doing this bosonic, but string theory, what we know about string theory is in the realm of supersymmetric theory, so we're going to make it supersymmetric, and we're not going to make it a little bit supersymmetric, we're going to make it as supersymmetric as it goes. So this is what's called the large n equals to 4 superconformal symmetry. And I'm going to save you lots of sweat and blood in this one slide by just suggesting that the only thing you have to do is instead of HS lambda, you write an S in front of it and you write a 2 below. So this is a slightly more complicated Lie algebra. And then on the right-hand side, you have to look at a slightly more complicated coset. These are these Wolf space cosets. And then the idea is that in the Tuft limit, you get a similar correspondence. And what we've done is we've basically done the same tests that I've spelled out for you in some detail for the bosonic analysis in this slightly more complicated case. And I'm not going to bother explaining to you in detail what these animals are, but they are supersymmetrized generalizations of these higher spin algebras. Yes. Not in any obvious way. I talked to him in Cambridge about it, but But I haven't yet arrived at string theory. I'm working myself slowly towards that. So this is meant to be somehow related to string theory on ADS3 cross S3 cross S3 cross S1, because that's what it means to have large n equals to 4 superconformal symmetry. So large n equals to 4 means your chiral algebra is a Virasoro algebra, two SU2s and a U1. There are two levels, and then the central charge is fixed in terms of the two levels. And because this Wolf space coset has this large n equals to 4 superconformal algebra inside it, you would believe it has something to do with higher spin theory on that background, and therefore should somehow be related to string theory on that background. Now, the problem is that, as some people in the audience know very well, nobody knows what the string theory dual, the CFT dual of string theory on this space is. This is a famously open problem, with various people trying to find, so in particular this paper, trying all sorts of obvious ideas or less obvious ideas, and for each of them, finding a flaw with them. So it's an open problem what the CFT dual of string theory in that background is. But we know what string theory dual of another background is, namely ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So this has been tested to death. So this has been strongly supported, the idea that string theory in ADS3 cross S3 cross T4 is dual to the symmetric orbit fold of T4. So you take n plus one copies of T4 and you divide out by the symmetric group Sn plus one. Now, obviously, these two things are apples and pears, because this has a small n equals to four and this has large n equals to four, as you can also see from the font. And therefore it's, I mean, here we have a higher spin duality, but we have no idea what string theory is. Here we have a stringy duality, but we have no idea what the higher spin theory is, because there's no good coset with small n equals to four. So on the face of it, you have two things you can't really compare. But now it's the benefit of being a string theorist or a physicist rather than a mathematician. What you can do is you can ask yourself, well, look, I mean, this is ADS3 cross S3 cross S3 cross S1, and this is ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So let's make one of the S3s really, 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 really big. So then this is really ADS3 cross S3 cross R3 cross S1. And then if we look at the right things, namely things that don't have any winding or momentum along the torus, that's essentially the same as ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So if you ask the right questions, you're not looking at things that wind around the S3 and you're not looking at things that have momentum along the T4, you should be able to connect them. And what you will have to do is you have to make the size of one of the S3s very large, which in the context of this Wolf space coset corresponds to taking the levels of one of the two SU2s very large, and the level is the parameter K in this coset. So we're going to take the K goes to infinity limit of this coset, and we hope to latch on to string theory or to some part of string theory. Remember, the higher spin theory should only be a subsector because it's the leading ratchet trajectory and the bilinears in the Young-Mills fields.
I'm curious, but is it obvious that your choice of like two things to look at is sort of invariant under T-duality?
Well, T-duality, what do you mean by T-duality? I mean, T-duality before you've taken the limit, there is no obvious T-duality because the S3 doesn't really have a U1 isometry in quite that way you would like it. On the T4, once you've gone to the T4, you have to worry about it. But we only look at the zero momentum winding sector. So that's, because I mean, that's what normally people look at. That's where all the BPS fund sits and so on. So what he suggests is that we should take the lambda equal to zero limit. And as I said, we should expect this to be a subsector of the symmetric orbit fold. Because remember, the high spin theory is just leading ratchet trajectory and bilinears. It's not the full string spectrum. So we should look at these Wolf space cosets, and we should ask what happens when I take lambda equal to zero in the Wolf space coset. So here are the Wolf space cosets in all their glory. So now you have to take k to infinity. So what happens when you take k to infinity? Well, for a Wessel-Minor-Witten model, when you take k to infinity, it just becomes dimension group free fields because the group gets flatter and flatter and flatter. So this just becomes n plus 2 squared minus 1 free bosons and this becomes n squared minus 1 free bosons. So what you see is you're left over with 4n plus 1 free bosons. And then I've already written it in sort of bosonic form. You have 4n plus 4 free fermions. And in the limit, sort of they just cancel out. But you can't quite forget that you were dividing by the denominator. So what happens in the limit is that you retain the condition that you should only look at the un singlets, which is the singlet condition of sun with u1. So what this theory becomes, or this part, in fact, what precisely this part of the spectrum becomes in this limit on the level of partition functions, conformal dimensions, everything you want, is it's a theory of 4n plus 1 free fermions and 4n plus 1 free bosons, where you only look at the states that are singlets with respect to the un, where the un acts on them in a very specific manner that you can read off from the way these things sit inside one another. I haven't specified precisely how the sun sits inside here, but that's something you can work out. In this way. So this is, I mean, this is how it comes out of, I mean, you look at this coset, comes with a fine print. So then what you find out is that it acts on, so I've written out the un and the SU2 of the surviving SU2 of the small n equals to four. So the bosons are singlets with respect to the SU2 and they sit, two of them sit in the n and two of them sit in the n bar and then there are four singlets. And the fermions sit in the n comma two, the n bar comma two, and two times sit in the one comma two. That's what comes out of, I mean, there's no, this is just you take this coset and you do this analysis, that's what you get. Now, this I should say only accounts for these representations. The other ones you can interpret as twisted sectors, but don't want to get into that. But this now looks very, very similar to the untwisted sector of the symmetric orbit fold. Because what's the untwisted sector of the symmetric orbit fold? Well, you have 4n plus 1 free bosons and 4n plus 1 free fermions. And how do they transform? Well, they transform under the SU2 in that the bosons are singlets and the fermions are doublets. And you have to ask, how do they transform under the under the permutation group. Now, there's a fact in life, which is that if you look at the permutation group Sn plus 1 and you look at the n plus 1 dimensional representation of Sn plus 1, this representation is not irreducible. Because that's a representation where you have 1 in every column and row, right? And therefore, the vector, which is the sum of all the vectors, is just left invariant under all the permutations. So the n plus 1 dimensional representation of the permutation group Sn plus 1 is not irreducible. It splits into a singlet and into an n-dimensional standard representation of Sn plus 1. That's the orthogonal complement of this one vector that's left invariant under all the permutations. So if I write this in terms of irreducible representations of the permutation group, this n plus 1 becomes an n plus 1. Again, purely representation theory of the symmetric group. Now, by the same token, by what I've just explained to you, this means there is a natural embedding of Sn plus 1 into un, because what you do is you start with your defining n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrices. You choose your one vector that's invariant, and then you choose a basis in which you have this vector and the orthogonal complement, and on the orthogonal complement, your n plus 1 permutation is an n by n matrix, and because everything is good, it's in fact orthogonal, but it's certainly unitary. So it gives you an embedding of Sn plus 1 into the unitary group. And then you can ask, what are the branching rules? How do the representations of un look like when I look at them with respect to the Sn plus 1 subgroup? Now, normally you would think that everything will fall into zillions of pieces because un is a compact group, it's a continuous group, and Sn plus 1 is just a tiny little discrete group. So typically, it's a much smaller group, so typically any representation will branch into zillions of pieces. But in fact, they don't. The fundamental representation of un becomes the standard representation of Sn plus 1 under this branching. And the antifundamental also becomes the same because you see the permutation group has only real representations and therefore the complex conjugate representation has to branch the same way. So therefore, if you now compare, you see in the Wolf coset, you have things transforming under un and SU2. And in the symmetric orbifold, you have things transforming under the standard representation. But this representation is really induced from this action upon the embedding of Sn plus 1 into un, because the branching of these un representations into Sn plus 1, this n and this n bar both become n, and this n and this n bar both become n, and you just get down this to this. So therefore, what follows from this is that if you look at the perturbative part of the CFT dual of higher spin theory and lambda in this limit, it's the un invariant part of the free theory. But here you are demanding invariance under un. And if you only were to demand invariance under Sn plus 1, then you're demanding fewer conditions. So this is a subspace of this space. But that's precisely the untwisted sector of the symmetric orbifold, which is believed, which is the CFT dual of string theory on ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So what this tells you is that the CFT, so we don't understand how the higher spin theory sits inside string theory, but we understand what the mirror image of the CFT duals is. The CFT dual of higher spin theory, which is this Wolf coset, is very naturally a subsector of the CFT dual of string theory, because it's not just the states that are Sn plus 1 invariant, it's those states that are actually un invariant. So this is precisely the way we would have liked to see higher spin theory emerge in string theory, because on the sphere, if we look at correlation functions on the sphere, this is not just a subspace, it's also a subalgebra, right? The OPE of two states that are UN invariant will be UN invariant. So this will form some closed subsector, just like you would have liked the leading ratchet trajectory to form a closed subsector by itself, or the bilinears of the free theory to form a subsector by itself. It's clearly not modular invariant, but nobody told you that Vasiliev theory would be modular invariant. Vasiliev theory is a classical theory. It's not clear that if you quantize it, it's going to work just like this, and it doesn't. But as a classical theory, that's the degrees of freedom that are captured of it. And these degrees of freedom are very naturally a subsector of string theory, of the CFT dual of string theory on ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So this in particular suggests also that the symmetric orbifold corresponds to the point in moduli space where the string theory has become tensionless. That should be the place where string theory has become tensionless. And the CFT dual of the higher spin theory is a very natural subsector of that dual CFT. So what does this mean concretely? You see, for example, what this means is that the full stringy algebra you can write in terms of representations of your W infinity algebra, and you're going to have some multiplicities, and you can calculate them from a group theoretic interpretation. So lambda runs over all representations of un. You look at the branching rules, you look at them as representations of Sn plus 1, and d lambda is the number of singlets that appear when you branch the U n representation lambda with respect to Sn plus 1. And this gives you a prediction for what this is. This is the prediction. And then you compare with the DMVV formula, and it works. I mean, it has to work. We haven't made a mistake. So it's obvious that it has to work. But it's a highly non-trivial test that all of this works out. Yes?
Earlier in the talk, you mentioned that you could complete the spectrum to something that looks more promising by adding conical defects.
Right.
And now, here, of course, there's another natural promotion, which is you add all the states of cement.
Absolutely.
How is the two related?
Well, I'll come to that in a second. So here, in fact. So the stringy, well, I mean, part of these extra conical defects are what are called the light states. So these are not part of the so what you do in this string theory picture is that you extend your gauge fields by additional stringy symmetries. You make the vacuum character bigger, and as a consequence, some of the representations disappear from your spectrum. In particular, the representations of these classical, of most of the classicals, are higher spin solutions that were described by these conical defects. These are not untwisted representations of this extended chiral algebra, and therefore they disappear from the spectrum. So the space-time interpretation, in my mind, is what this means is that these classical higher spin solutions, when you try to embed them into string theory, they are not going to define solutions of string theory.
So this also solves the problem that Schenker.
Yes. 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 So because you, in this context, you make the chiral algebra simply bigger by adding in by hand. So you're doing something by hand. You're making your symmetries larger by adding in by hand additional degrees of freedom. But you solve the problem of the light states and all these things, and you just get a, because you just reproduce the symmetric orbifold, which everybody knows to be have all the good features you like. Yes. Okay. So one way of thinking about it is what this really means is that we are looking at a vastly extended chiral algebra. So at this point in moduli space, what we are doing is we're not looking at the standard charge conjugation moduli invariant, but we're looking at a vastly extended moduli invariant. And this we've understood at lambda equal to zero, but if you're an optimist, I'm not sure whether you're an optimist at 4:15, you're probably just desperate for coffee. But if you were an optimist, then you could believe that maybe this works also away from lambda equal to zero. And maybe this gives you a new handle for how to construct the CFT dual for string theory in ADS 3 crosses 3 crosses 3 crosses 1. And this is one of the things I would love to do, but I need some powerful help in constructing moduli invariants because this is going to be non-trivial moduli invariants. I should also say that this gives a very explicit description of this maximal stringy symmetry, what people in the old days always raved about. And here we can really unravel their algebraic structure, and that's one of the things I'm working with at the moment. We are trying to understand the sort of the higher spin version of this. So you have this massively extended chiral algebra, but now you can ask, what is the analog of HS lambda from which it came? What is the sort of global part of the symmetry whose asymptotic extension is the stringy symmetry algebra? And that should be the global symmetries of string theory in ADS 3 crosses 3. And this is something we are trying to work out. And this is bound to have a nice algebraic relation. So this is not going to be SL lambda. This is going to be a much, much bigger algebra. It has
a classical theory.
Yes, it must have a class. Well, but it'll be something.
We still don't know.
We are getting closer. We are going to write another paper about this soon. And then hopefully we'll kind of give a more convincing answer. But I can't yet say anything. The other thing we have done recently is, you see, if you look at this expansion, the way you should look at this expansion is that these are the higher spin fields, and these are the additional massless spin fields that are part at the stringy point. So these should correspond to the sub-leading redshift trajectories. So in one way to determine that is to perturb the theory away from the symmetric orbifold point by switching on the perturbation that goes you, takes you away from the symmetric orbifold point. And what should happen then is that some of these generators, in fact, also the W infinity generator, should acquire an anomalous dimension and should become should cease to be symmetries of your theory. But the anomalous dimension you can relate to the mass of the corresponding spin state. So you can plot the mass of these fields as a function of the spin when you perturb the first order in away from the symmetric orbifold point. So the picture that seems to be emerging is that the quadratic terms you can think of as being the leading redshift trajectory, and that the cubic terms from the point of view of the symmetric orbifold look like the first subleading, the quarti like the second subleading. So this is in the process of being done. So here we've plotted the mass over the mass squared over the spin of each of these fields as a function of the spin when you perturb to first order away from the symmetric orbifold point. And so if this was flat space, then you would have expected this to be not like a hockey stick, but like a flat line. That would be a perfect redshift trajectory. Now here we are in ADS, so The picture may not be quite the same, but you see a sort of a pattern. It looks like this looks like the leading ratchet trajectory. This looks like the first subleading ratchet trajectory. And we hope to be able to push this a bit further. These calculations are quite hard, but in this way, you're going to recover how you should think about these different spin fields, because you can, by going away from it, you can sort of switch on the mass to lowest order. Okay, so this is I think my time is up. So what I've tried to do is explain for you the evidence for this bosonic minimal model holography, then I sketch the large n equals to 4 generalization. In this SUSY case, the CFT dual of higher spin theory sits very naturally inside the CFT dual of string theory. It's the UN invariant piece from the symmetric orbifold, so it's a very natural subalgebra. I think this gives a concrete realization of the idea that higher spin theory emerges as a subsector of string theory at this point in one, at this tensionless point. And there are many things we would like to understand. It would be nice to sort of understand this higher spin point of view from more directly from the D1, D5 point of view. Then there's this spin chain picture, which is sort of the integrable way of dealing with string theory in ADS3 cross S3 cross T4 S3 cross S1. That should somehow be, that's a more or less the same point in moduli space. So that should somehow tie up. And then we would like to learn what's the Lie algebra structure of the string asymmetry. What's the analog of HS lambda, whose asymptotic symmetry algebra is the string asymmetry. We would like to find the other stringy moduli invariants, solving the problem of what's the CFT dual of string theory in ADS 3 cross S3 cross S3 cross S1. And then finally, it would be nice to see to which extent lessons that are very explicit and very concrete here tie up with what happens in higher dimensions. I mean, ultimately, I don't want to end my life working on ADS 3. I would like to move up in dimension slowly. Probably it has to go in integer steps, but it would be nice to see what's the sort of to which extent this is similar or different to what happens. It seems to be quite different to this proposal of Chang, Minwala, Sharma, and Yin in one dimension higher, but maybe it goes in steps of two. It doesn't look that dissimilar from what happens in ADS 5 plus S5, so that would clearly be interesting to understand. But I'll stop with this. And before I stop, I should. I was one of the organizers, but I was a very silent organizer. There was really one organizer who did most of the work. And I think he should get a round of applause. That was Shamit. He was really the person who would remind us that we have to do things. And then and I think the other person we should thank is Stephanie Moll, because she has probably been doing the real work of reminding Shamit to remind us to do things. So we should give her. Okay, very good. But maybe we should. You should tell her that she was properly thanked. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Can you maybe quickly explain what the obstruction you think is to David's proposal for the ABS 3 process to the process?
Well, I'm not sure whether there's an obstruction. It's just that the symmetric orbifold, I know what to do. I can write on a partition function, and I can write on a character, and so on. With David's proposal, I'm not entirely sure how I extract any very explicit information from it. It's not clear to Lee how you would actually calculate the spectrum, or how you would calculate. I mean, he describes some theory that flows in the infrared to this, and it's very hard to.
An index from where n equals 4, and even in a massive model, you should be able to compute the index.
Yeah, so that's what you should do. I mean, I can certainly calculate my index, yes. I mean, I think it's interesting to understand to which extent it fits, and there's more work to be done to fit that, but I think his description is not in a frame that I can directly compare with what I have, because it's not as concrete as the symmetric orbifold. So I feel, if I may say, I feel the onus is a little bit on him to tell me a sharp prediction which I can then compare to that. I can't extract it directly from his paper. Yes.
I think I've asked you this before, but maybe something nonsense. But yeah, so there's no literature on what the radio trajectories are if you're in ABS space.
This I don't know. I would be interested to hear if there is a literature on that. I mean, it's true, I should probably look more carefully for the literature. That's what our calculation gives us. And we are bold enough to say, so that's how ADS3 should behave. But if there was a literature, that would be very interesting. But I'm not aware of it. But if anybody knows anything about it, I'd be very interested to hear.
Okay. All right, let's take Matisse again.